is Griff. Tonight's flights, we're going to be singing, for the most part, songs about this man, Johnny Vance. Thank you for choosing American Interior. Your safety and enjoyment is my priority tonight. So, before we begin, I'd like to pinpoint some exits. We've got two over the wings of this. Well, if you feel nauseous during the show, you know, if strobe lightning affects you, you know, maybe you'll be wanting to use one of the exits. There's another one in the back. Someone's waving. There's one in the sky. There's an exit up in the sky there. So, if you could pay your full attention, please, before we begin, to the following safety video. It's a bit archaic. It's a bit like this aeroplane tonight. But it might help you with your personal safety and enjoyment of the following songs. So, in theory, I'm going to press play, and we're going to switch the lights off, and the film, the introductory safety video, is going to play, and then we'll be right back. Thank you very much.
The old has its myths and legends. Some the products of a vivid imagination, others perhaps based on fact. One of the earliest and most persistent stories has been that of a mysterious nation of white-skinned, Welsh-speaking Indians, descendants of the first white man to cross the Atlantic and discover America. Mexico, gateway to a continent, is gateway to a land of myths. Unraveling the facts, if any there be, behind the legend of Madoc and the Welsh Indians, has been something of an obsession with Gwyn Williams, Professor of History at the University College, Cardiff.
This is a magic land, this Gulf of Mexico, a fable shore. From the earliest days of European settlement, marvels came out of it. In 1519, to this Mobile Bay came a Spaniard to build a city out of nothing. And in that same year, back in Spain, a famous cartographer drew a map of this area and wrote on it the words Tierra de los Gales, the land of the Welsh. So this is the most marvelous marvel of them all. Because in this very place, or so some say, in the year of our Lord 1170, a Welsh prince, Madoc ap Owain Gwynedd, planted his Welsh foot in this new world.
But the origin of the legend is in the old. Gwynedd, heartland of the Welsh, has always looked seaward. Its princes sailed with the Vikings. In the 12th century, these princes clawed their way up out of the wreck of the Norman conquest to independence. Defended by the great ring bastions of mountains, Griffith ap Cynan, a Welsh Viking, built a new dynasty out of the ruins of the old. His son Owain expanded his father's domains until Gwynedd covered the greater part of the north. It towered over the little Balkan-like cockpit of medieval Wales. Owain Gwynedd, in the words of the Chronicle, was a man who was of great goodness and possessing great nobility and prudence, the strength of all Wales. But the Welsh seem always to have shunned the course to unity and strength. Gwynedd's charismatic rise could not be maintained. In In 1170, Owain Gwynedd died. With his death, his kingdom decayed. His heirs hurled Gwynedd into a bitter period of feuding and civil war. But not so one of his sons, Madoc. Born, so legend has it, in this castle of Dolidelan, he was a man of peace. While his brothers tore apart the kingdom, he, sickened by the slaughter, looked for escape and a new land. Of this Madoc, there is not a trace in the authentic chroniclers and poets of medieval Wales. Not a trace. But in the 13th century, a Dutch poet, Willem, writes of a Madoc who sailed far to the west to discover magic islands and a sea of weed. An Icelandic saga seems of a freeman of Wales who sailed to the islands of the south. 1559, Tudor geographer Humphrey Lloyd writes,
"And Madoc left the land in contention betwixt his brethren, and sailing west, leaving the coast of Ireland so far north, he came to a land unknown. This land of Madoc must needs be that country of which the Spaniards affirm themselves to be the first finders. Of this voyage of Madoc there be many fables, but sure it is that there he was."
To this day, many still believe.
Madoc, over the arches of fear, over the arc of the earth, Madoc sailed out of the dark night, out from the shadows of dread.
Behind contemporary claims lies a wealth of historical support for the Madoc legend. Alexander von Humboldt thought it worth serious consideration. So did the American Antiquarian Society, the Smithsonian Institute, and Davy Crockett.
Madoc is virtually a god to me. It's the same as finding a god in your own backyard.
By the 20th century, 15 Indian languages had been identified as Welsh. A minister of the 17th century, it is claimed, preached to the natives in Welsh. And so respectable museums and institutions still hang on to the Madoc story and proudly display the plaques of Madoc. Proud, medieval Welsh prince. Belief in the Welsh connection is fueled by a series of prehistoric forts. Built, some say, not by the native Indians, but by the Welsh.
According to the theory, he came over here in 1170 and came up the various rivers, the Alabama River, its tributaries, and so on. And it seems to me that it makes considerable sense to say that he built the fort.
Well, there are many legends, you know, in this continent of the early white explorers who settled here and intermarried with the natives. And this one is of quite long standing, but I think probably it was revived actively about 20 years ago when Miss Zella Armstrong wrote a book on the subject.
In 1953, the Daughters of the American Revolution, no less, raised a plaque to Madoc on Mobile Bay, citing the forts and Roman coins allegedly found in them.
The evidence here is a pretty bizarre mix. A 20th century encyclopedia that simply tells the story. Webster simply says there was a legend. Hakluyt, now that's the first serious evidence. Hakluyt wasn't Welsh, he was from Herefordshire, but his great work, Principal Navigation of the English People, was the very voice of the first British imperialism under Queen Elizabeth, and it was Hakluyt's book which gave the Madoc stories to the world, so that's a solid piece of evidence. The forts in Tennessee, these also existed. Roman coins in them, well, I hadn't realized the Roman legions marched this far, or the Roman traders got this far. If there were Roman coins in forts in Tennessee, then every history book ever written would have to be rewritten. But the forts certainly existed. They stretch from here in Mobile up through to the Ohio and even beyond to the Missouri. Now, those courts have been linked with tribes of white Indians. And in the 18th century, those white Indians were identified as Welsh Indians. Their forts are said to look like Welsh forts. Well, a fort is a fort is a fort. But Welsh Indians were linked with these forts, running from Mobile Bay all the way up to the Missouri. And it's thought that the Madocian Indians, if they existed, came through Mobile, moved right up through the heart of America, up the Mississippi, up the Missouri, where they enjoyed their golden age as a Mandan Indians. And that is what we have to do. We have to follow the trail of Madoc out of Hakluyt, over the Atlantic, through Mobile Point, up to the Missouri, and find out what truth there is in the story. We may find there's little truth in it. We may find there's no truth in it. But that won't be enough, because what people believe to have been true, particularly if they acted on it, is as significant for history as what actually was true. Myth itself can become an operative historical reality.
On the screen, could we have less lights, please? Senor Lights, thank you very much. So, welcome to American Interior. So, we're going to be, as I mentioned, singing some songs about John Evans. He believed in Prince Madoc, the guy they talked about in the film just now. This is the only known image of Madoc. So, he was obviously a very charismatic, mythical prince. So it's no wonder that John Evans wanted to go looking for him and his descendants. And as they mentioned, it was believed that in 1170, Madoc made his way across the Atlantic into the Gulf of Mexico, and his descendants eventually became a tribe of Welsh-speaking people roaming the American interior, possibly.
Yeah.
So, in the 18th century, some French explorers started to make their way into the American interior, and they started to notice some signs of the previous Welsh occupation of that continent, namely through sightings of this type of boat. This is a conical boat, typical of Wales. It's a leather-bound boat for one, and this guy works in the finance sector. He's commuting to work. This was taken this morning, and he was on the way to the bank in West Wales. There he goes. So, you know, in the 18th century, these French explorers who'd probably never been to Wales started to notice that, you know, they used boats very similar to what they believed were Welsh boats. And they got very excited. They thought, oh my God, maybe it's true. Maybe Prince Madoc really did make it into the American interior. And news got back to Wales. People got really, really excited, especially this man, Iolo Morgannwg. Iolo. And he was an interesting man. He was a radical poet. He was an anti-slavery activist. He had fantastic hair. And he was also a lifelong opium addict. And he had an amazing plan. He thought you need to start an expedition to go out to America, and everyone could, you know, the Welsh language was being repressed. Rich landowners were also repressing the workers. It was a nightmare, so it was a good time to leave Wales. And he had a plan, you know, they'd go on this expedition, make friends with the lost tribe of Wales, and then arrange that everyone leave Wales and come and start, you know, a new utopian Wales with the democratic and Native American values in the middle of America. And it was a fantastic idea, and this song is about Iolo. If you're unfamiliar with the name Iolo, you're likely to be familiarised. Very good. You're likely to be familiarised within about 20 seconds. So, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Pepperidge, so Yellow went on a speaking tour of Wales, trying to radicalise young people to join them on the expedition. Unfortunately, there was only one applicant. He was a 20-year-old family brother called John Evans. He didn't have much going for him. His parents were dead. Why not join an expedition looking for a mythical tribe? You know. So, not much is known about him, but it's known that he was born in this house in 1770, in this room. And, you know, it's a beautiful house. Unfortunately for him, he had to move when his mother died, when he was 7 years old. The whole family moved to a one-room dwelling on the mountainside, which is mud on the floor and a simple dial-up connection for the PC. And, you know, and people like him wouldn't have been drawn or painted. We can only speculate as to what he would have really looked like. Only rich landowners and people were drawn, you know. So, you know, about 2 years ago, I would see my mate Pete, and he did a lot of extensive DNA testing in John Evans's home village, and he basically worked out exactly what he would have looked like. And this is the first drawing he ever made of John Evans based on fact. And some people call this the Turin Shroud of John Evans. In any case, by coincidence, around this time I saw a film that was new to me. It's called Jurassic Park. And it's about these dinosaurs that they bring back to life. It's amazing if you ever get a chance to see it. You know, I thought it'd be amazing if you could bring back to life this 18th century explorer. So I took these drawings to Wrexham to see my friend Louise, and she started to rebuild John Evans for a new age, just like those dinosaurs. And I'm extremely happy to be able to announce that today, for only the third time in Edinburgh, that the 18th century explorer himself, Mr. John Evans, has been able, possibly, to join us on stage. And the suspense is killing me. I believe it's very close. Eventually, that summer's day in Wrexham, he offered to take me back on the journey he took in the 1790s in search of the tribe. So I asked him, you know, what happened, and he was saying he was just, you know, hanging around in the one-room dwelling with a mud floor and probably playing ox or something in the ground, you know, with a stick. And Yolo, the guy with the crazy hair, phoned him up, said, you know, John, come and meet me in London. We're going to try and hassle rich people for cash for this expedition. Come and join me. So John Evans walked for 3 weeks to London. So we decided to follow his journey exactly like the original journey, except we were a bit short of time. So. Off he went, you know, he would have arrived in London, made his way Thames, and they probably had like a proposal that they took to, you know, people in high places and stuff looking for support for the expedition. Unfortunately, it lacked some credibility. Nobody would give them any money. And Iolo went back to Wales depressed. Yeah, it's true. And then, but you could see in the eyes of John Evans, he was made of different stuff. You can see the steel in his eyes. And nothing would stop this man. He was now 21 years old. He was homeless in London. It was extremely hard for him, but he just persevered, hassling people for cash. And eventually, after about a year, possibly to get rid of him, someone gave him enough money to make a one-way crossing of the Atlantic, and that's where he went, all the way to the capital of crack cocaine and the wire, Baltimore. There he goes. And this song is about the terrible journey he endured. It took 2 or 3 months, and it was a much fun. And it's called Shark Ridden
I've been feeling like a pony on the ring in the air.
Thank you very much. So John Evans landed in America. He's 22 years old. He's 1792. He hears some new bird sounds and stuff. Then he goes for a nice coffee. And then eventually makes his way. It's about a 3-week walk, gradually up to the head of the Ohio River. This is the Ohio River. It looks better when you're there, you know. And his plan was to harness the power of the river systems of America to make his way into the American interior. There was some slight problems with this because there was wars going on and stuff, and now he was leaving the American, the new American civilization of the USA in Pittsburgh, and heading into pristine wilderness. And so this song is about walking into the wilderness, and it's called Walk Into the Wilderness. Every reason.
Laji 9.
Mississippi River, everything west of the Mississippi at this point was under the jurisdiction of the King of Spain, and he was a bit like, I mean, John Evans was a bit like David Bowie or someone in the 1970s. He was going through constant transformations. He was only 23, he had the full head of hair, everything was going really great, and he decided that the best way to get into the American interior was to defect to Spain. And so at this point, he crosses the Mississippi, and John Evans becomes Don Juan Evans. So it's an amazing time for him, you know, and unfortunately, within 10 days of his defection, he's struck down by malaria. This is a major setback in his quest to discover the lost tribe of Mad Dog. There he is on the side of the banks of the great Mississippi River. You know, he's on death's door, so he decides to do what anyone would do in this situation. He decides to walk 2,000 miles to the north. Nothing would scare this man. You can see it in his eyes. If you could only see his eyes at the heart. He even mentioned at the time, not even death will stop me from reaching the tribe, so, which doesn't make any sense at all, so, but that's what he said, and so he carried on with his journey in a malarial hallucination. It's August 1793, the sun in the Mississippi Basin is 40 degrees Celsius, it's pounding on his head, he's collapsing every 200 yards from exhaustion, the banks are surrounded by swampland, so for the most part he has to walk in the river itself. He's now surrounded by beasts, he has no idea what they are. He's new to the alligator. Now, in the Mississippi River, his clothes disintegrate. He's naked, in a malarial hallucination, surrounded by alligators, walking in uncharted territory. He's got no money, but that's okay, there's no shops. But, you know, this is a crazy thing to do, but he survived somehow because he documented it all in letters, which also reveal a tendency for exaggeration. And in any case, the lyrics for this next song are all taken from those letters, and it goes a bit like this.
Thank you.
died in poverty beneath the wilderness of America. Born a separable test and a series of mirrors with a capacity. Now lost in the infinite wilderness of America. Take a pound of journey, and by December 1784 he'd made it to the French-speaking village of St. Louis, and he went to the authorities and said, "Hello, I am Tangent. My name is Johnny Vance. I'm here searching for a lost tribe descended from the mythical prince Mad Dog." So they were very suspicious of this one, and he was immediately arrested. Situation. Johnny Vance was taken to a freezing dungeon. It was minus 10 degrees Celsius in St. Louis, and he was taken to the dungeon, chained to the wall, and that's where he lived for the next few months. It's now January 1795. He's still in the dungeon. This is a major setback in his quest to discover the lost tribe of Prince MacDog. You know, it's difficult to see a way out of this one. Luckily for him, occasionally on the weekends they take him out to the town stocks where people could throw stuff at him for light relief. And one of these people, one Saturday afternoon, was this man, Commandante James Santiago Mackay, a renegade Scottish general. I can't speculate whether he was a bastard or not, but he seems a pretty safe pair of hands in this drawing. You know? In any case, he was a Scottish renegade general working for the Spanish, and the King of Spain, Carlos, had asked him to lead the biggest expedition ever mounted on the Mississippi River by the Spanish, a fleet of boats, and the plan was to find the Northwest Passage to the Pacific Ocean. And he'd also heard about the myth of Prince MacDog, and when he heard, he struck up some light conversation with Johnny Vance when he was throwing a potato at him, and he heard something incredible, that Johnny Vance was a Welsh speaker, and he was like, oh my God. This is great. He's really excited. And he saw an opportunity. If he could take John Evans with him on the expedition, should they run into the lost tribe, the Prince MacDog, John Evans could interpret, and they could get on, you know, with a journey with the help of the tribe. And, you know, it was a great idea. And next thing, John Evans is out of the dungeon, and he's an interpreter on this incredible Spanish expedition. Not only that, he gets on so well with James Mackay he makes him second in command. John Evans is now second in command on this, the biggest expedition ever mounted on the Mississippi by the Spanish. It's, you know, you could make it up. There's a Scotsman and a Welshman leading a boat full of French-speaking rivermen working for the King of Spain. They're going off the known map of the world together. You know, it's a big adventure. So this is about their fantastic working relationship. It's called If We Were Words, We Would Rhyme. Thank you. Pakirmet, so on they go on the journey into the unknown. They're leaving the known map and they're heading up the Missouri River, one of the world's biggest rivers. Off they go. Gets pretty monotonous, you know. It was maybe exciting at first. They're going into a pristine wilderness and, you know, it's pretty incredible. It's a long way. And anyway, after about 2 months, they get to the great Omaha Nation, where their great chief, formidable chief, Blackbird, blockades the river. He does own a load of colonial bastards destroying their great way of life. And but Chief Blackbird is a reasonable man, and he lets, he invites the Spanish to stay at the Omaha villages over the winter, because winter is closing in, and then they can leave, you know, when the summer comes. But he befriends John Evans, he takes him on a 21-day bison hunt, and eventually he agrees that John Evans should be allowed to carry on his own journey as a reconnaissance mission. But, you know, he orders the Spanish to turn back, and before they turn back, McKay and his mate and his men, you know, they ask a few favours of John Evans. They ask him to map the whole region. There he is, mapping away. And also, if you could find the Pacific Ocean, that'd be great. Yeah, no worries. It's also a time before science was thought of any value. People had no idea what was going on. So along with a type of well-speaking Native Americans, there was believed to be a herd of unicorn in the Rocky Mountains, and he's now asked to capture a live specimen and bring it back to St. Louis on his way back from the Pacific. Yeah, no worries. So, of course, John Evans on his own quest to discover the lost tribe.
Stay free, let's try.
So, and he goes on his journey. He's now chased for 300 miles by a Lakota hunting party. They've got no idea who this strange man is. He runs away, but eventually makes peace with the Lakota and carries on with his journey. And he's welcomed by the Sanish nation, who greet him like a travelling chief. He's got... So, he's greeted like a chief. He's got like gifts and stuff. He's got Spanish flags and stuff to give away. So like, oh, great. Confusingly, he's now called Jean Evans. He got a French name in St. Louis. But they invite chiefs and the representatives of tribes from as far as the Rocky Mountains to come and meet this new guy in the area. He's a real novelty, and it's an amazing time in his life. And this next song is about that incredible time. It's called Allweddillau, Allweddol. And it goes like this.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, John Evans now, he's been working for about a year from St. Louis, and now at the age of 26, he finally reaches the Mandan Nation, and they were believed to have coracle boats, like the Welsh, and at the time they were thought to be the best bet to be of Welsh descent from all the nations of North America, and you know, he walked into their great sounds. They were an amazing nation at the height of their civilization. You know, there was a center for commerce for the whole of North America. John Evans now witnessed the buffalo dance and the Okipa ceremony, where young men hang themselves by hooks from the chest, from the ceilings of the houses for 3 days at a time. It was just regular stuff there, you know, it's amazing. So, you know, it's just completely incredible time for him. And they saved his life, they gave him amazing food. They were some of the most hospitable people on earth. They lived basically in the future. They lived in amazing sort of eco domes that the height of sustainable living. We'll probably all be living like this in the year 3000, doesn't it? You know, like, it's just an amazing time. Coincidentally, another thing the Spanish asked of John Evans on his journey, they told him, if you see any British forts, you need to destroy them with light artillery or find some other way for them to leave. And he was out walking in the snow one day, and it was shit. He saw a British fort in Spanish territory. So he's at a bit of a loss what to do. So he went up to the door and he knocked on the door. He went, "Hello? Hello, my name is John Evans. I'm afraid you've built your forts in Spanish territory and you must leave, please." "Oh, I'm so sorry. Of course, no problem." The British left the fort, went back to Canada. So John Evans goes in, takes down the Union Jack, puts up the Spanish flag, accidentally annexing about a third of North America, and arguably establishing the future border of the USA and Canada at the 49th parallel, making him effectively the last conquistador of the, you know, whole of the Spanish Empire in the Americas. So, you know, it wasn't something he planned out to do in life, especially, it was just a niche he fell into, you know. So this song is called The Last Conquistador, and it's about John Evans being the last conquistador. And it goes a bit like this. All the world of Unfortunately for General Evans, the Spanish and the British now declare war on each other in Europe, and General Evans is single-handedly guarding the longest border in the Spanish Empire. So the British are pissed off with General Evans, so they sent down an assassin from Canada to try and kill John Evans. And what happens is John Evans was just watching TV one night in his farms, sat on a cactus, and the Canadian assassin entered through this door, and unbeknownst to John Evans, he pointed a gun to the back of his head. Luckily, a friend of John Evans, Amanda, an interpreter, was happening to walk past, and he saw the Canadian assassin enter the building, and he entered behind him, and he attacked the Canadian assassin repeatedly, violently. And took the gun from his hand and gave it to John Evans, who turned round in an incredible move pointing the gun at the Canadian assassin. But in that moment he remembered, oh, hold on, I'm like a pacifist and stuff. Whoa. So instead, as compromise, he challenged the Canadian assassin to a duel to the death. And the Canadian assassin declined the duel, which is something you should, a bit of information you should keep, you know, if anyone challenges you to a duel. You can apparently say no thank you, and leave, which I didn't know was the case. So the Canadian left and walked back through the deep snow to Canada. leaving John Evans pretty smug, I imagine, at the 49th parallel there, you know. Everything seemed to be going pretty well. Well, not quite what I had in mind. Could have less audience in the monitor position. So he's now at the 49th parallel, and you know, there's just a slight problem. Everything's pretty good, but there's a slight problem. He's now been walking since he left the East Coast of America. He's been walking for about 5 years. And, you know, he's lived now with the Mandan Nation for about 9 months. He previously lived with a series of the Great River Tribes of the Missouri Basin. He's met representatives from nations from all over the North American continent, who have come to trade at the Manta villages, and he comes to the conclusion that none of these people are in any way whatsoever, not even the slightly bit Welsh at all. And, you know, he's devastated, he's suffered life-threatening disease, you know, malaria, he's been jailed, people have tried to kill him, he's lived in London for a little bit, you know, it's like a series of hardships, you know, and, well, he's homeless in London, you know, there's such a heavy 6 years, you know, and only to find himself the most isolated European in North America, and his whole reason for existing seems to be some kind of joke. He's like, you know, he suffered so much to get here, and he's devastated. He now realizes he's just been some kind of pawn in a stupid colonial game, and he's pissed off with Iolo for getting overexcited by a kind of vague myth. You know, the original Welsh myth was something like a Madog left and sailed to the west, and that's about it, you know. So maybe he got to Ireland, I don't know. But when Wales was annexed, the Elizabethan court took this myth and they added some bits to it. And Madoc sailed to the west and discovered America centuries before Columbus, and it was a way for them to claim North America. And, oh my God, you know, over the years the Welsh forgot that it wasn't true, and it's a nice story, and, you know, it kind of makes out that Wales was the Portugal of the North, you know. So, and in any case, he's devastated. He goes to a nearby forest, he chops down a tree in anger with an axe, and he starts to fashion it into a boat-like craft. And for the first time on his journey, he decides to turn back. He decides to reassess what he's doing here, and he thinks maybe he can try his luck in the capital of New Spain, New Orleans. And so he goes to see Chief Blackcat from the Manta and says, thanks for everything. I've just got to sort something my head out, you know. I'll be back soon. So off he goes. He thunders down the Missouri River, which flows into the Mississippi. And if you combine these two rivers, it's the longest river in the world, which it isn't because it's two rivers. But you know, it's a hell of a long way, and he thundered down, and after some, you know, 68 days or something, he thundered into the swampy funk of New Orleans, hoping to build a new life for himself. He moved into this flat, and, you know, things seemed to be going pretty well, but things didn't quite turn out like he'd hoped. The malaria returned. Obviously, his whole purpose of being seemed pointless after he'd failed to find the lost tribe. He got a touch of cholera. Some people think now he got heavily into booze. In any case, it couldn't get much worse for John Evans. Except now it does. At the age of 29, he dies. The swamp, it pulls me cradles me down. The heat destroys me. The deathbed foul. Shut the LSD scene in the film Easy Rider. That's where he was buried, so it's very handy because we can speculate that his funeral would have looked pretty much exactly like this. And As you can see, you know, Dennis Hopper is in Sears. You can see that Sear in his right eye there. Filming. Live. And Peter Fonda is inconsolable. You know, Karen Black here is zoning out deep with the memories of all those great times they had with their Welsh pal John. So sad. And randomly, here's Tony Basil dreaming of a future pop hit, novelty pop hit Mickey, about 270 years later, you know, which seems to be a fitting end to the unusual. Journey of John Evans, but it doesn't quite end there. About 5 years after his death, the Americans took New Orleans, and from the Spanish and the French, and they, you know, pillaged the documents, and they found John Evans's maps of the American interior, and these maps were passed on to the explorers Lewis and Clark. The American explorers, and they used them to, you know, for their the first year of their successful journey to the Pacific Ocean. So he's got a legacy, you know, as a cartographer. He's a bit like most people. He started off in life with one idea, what he wanted to do, in this case, finding a mythical lost tribe. And unfortunately, he didn't find the tribe, but he fell into his own niche on the way, and that's what life's like for most of us, I suppose. And I mean, Lewis and Clark's journey was successful in that they found the Pacific, but, you know, if you're a colonial bastard, you know, it's very successful. Unfortunately, they also distributed syphilis throughout the continent, and led to a lot of suffering for the peoples of North America. So, you know, it's a mixed bag, but he far exceeded, you know, what he was supposed to have achieved in a funny way. In any case, there's some more statistics. So that's a bit of background information about this obscure Welsh explorer. We're now ready to start the show. And the first song tonight is called 100 Messages. And this is from the perspective of a family member living in that one-room dwelling on the mountain with just a mud floor, and every morning his two brothers and sister, they're waking up and they're firing up that old PC and checking to see if there's any emails from John. Unfortunately, he never wrote, and he was, you know, in some isolated places. The technology didn't exist and stuff like that. Anyway, it goes like this. Settled in America, we'll find it over there. Sailing in Baltimore, well, everything's okay. You burned out the jacket, shine like a penny. You want to do it. taught you to make maps. He showed you in piety and pity that he lacks. So you are Dr. Pittsburgh, waiting for the water to rise. Sent sail down the Ohio with a lost gem on your mind. Thank you very much to Quinn Noor for opening up. Thank you to Chris Skidlow for playing the drums. Texas. Survived assassination, worked upon your maps. But the lost tribe was a lost cause, and he cried a sign unto you. Led by two St. Louis and a familiar friends here. You said that you loved me.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, this next song, we decided to play when we were driving in 20 minutes a day. No, that's not the song. We saw that the famous volcano at the seat. And so we thought we'd sing a song called The Court of King Arthur. I will try and change the lyrics to be geographically specific. But, yeah, is it still active? Be spectacular when the lava comes pouring in from the back. Well, who knows which way it would come? Wait, I don't even know which way we're facing. Is it over there?
Yeah. Over
there? Okay, there's some kind of debate. Maybe we could have a vote on which way is Arthur's seat. So, are you? Okay, we can. Oh yeah. Yeah, hold on. Whoa. Sean's got a compass. Over there. Okay. In any case.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye.